Greetings, everyone. Welcome back to That's a Take. Here we are at episode 5. This one's going to be a little bit different than what you've heard before because today is our first case study. A case study on That's a Take is going to be a podcast where we discuss one particular project, often with multiple people. For our first case study, we are speaking with director Dylan Sires and producer Christian Day about Amazon Studios' documentary Chiefsaholic, A Wolf in Chief's Clothing. I had the opportunity to work closely with Dylan and Christian on this film, and I really wanted them to come on and talk about their experiences. For those of you who are not familiar with the film, it is an American true crime documentary film directed by Dylan Sires. It follows Kansas City Chiefs supervan Xavier Babadar's secret life as a serial bank robber. It explores his arrest through his own interviews and subsequent legal journey, as well as interviews of other Chiefs fans, a bank teller who was the victim of his final robbery, and Babadar's bail bondsman, Michael Lloyd. The film was released on December 24th, 2024, on Amazon Prime. Like I said, we'll be speaking with both Dylan Sires and Christian Day about Chiefsaholic, so let's get right to it, starting with Dylan.
That was funny when I went the da-na-na, you knew exactly what I was talking about.
The Brutalist. Yeah, The Brutalist.
No, I woke up at 2:30 in the morning, and so I checked my phone, and, you know, I had pre-ordered the film, because I was actually going to try to take my wife to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, hey, let's go to a movie, date night, and stuff like that, and she's like, sure, yeah, let's go. What movie do you want to go see? And I was like, oh, it's a movie called The Brutalist. It's, we can go see it at the Varsity. It'd be pretty cool, and she's like, okay, cool. She's really into 90s rom-coms, so, like, definitely not a movie for her, but, you know, she would have done it for me. And then she was like, well, how long is it? And I was like, it's over 2 hours. And she's like, yeah, but how long is it? And I was like, here, let me look it up. I already knew how long it was. I was like, oh, it's 3 hours and 35 minutes, but I guess it has a 15-minute intermission. And she's like, we are not going to a three-hour movie when we have two kids. And so I wasn't able to go see it in the theaters, and I felt bad about that. So I pre-ordered it, and I started watching it last night at about 3 o'clock in the morning. And like I blinked, and I was already like 25 minutes in. I was like, oh shit, this is like a dense film. It was awesome. And I was like, I'm putting this down.
Yeah.
Because I would have stayed up the whole time watching that movie. I was like, I have to force myself to like put it down. Yeah, so I could get some sleep.
Speaking of the epicness wearing you out,
yeah,
you're at the end of Chiefsaholic, like it's been released to the public. We'll just start there. How does it feel that, you know, so many people had the opportunity to watch it on a really big scale, and like what was the, you know, feedback that you got, and how do you feel about it?
I feel great about the film, you know. Worked really hard, worked insanely hard on it, and I mean you worked insanely hard on it, a lot of people did. I mean, the feedback that I've gotten has been awesome, though I've seen some really good troll reviews that, you know, producer Christian Day, you know, like that we've laughed about in our war room where we kind of plan stuff out. One of the funniest ones I saw was like, this could have been an email.
Oh, story, man. About it.
You know, you see that, you're like, oh, wow, wow. You know, but all in all, you know, I think it did great. It did well. I got to make the film I wanted to make. Not a lot of people get that opportunity to do that. You know, it's kind of like a human drama in a sports related movie. So, you know, the numbers did great. So I'm very happy with it.
That's great. And I think the origin story is kind of interesting to talk about, like how you just found out about this.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell that story quick? Because I think that's, I don't know. The fact that we are like sitting here, you know, 2 years later, and this is how it all came to be is wild to me.
Yeah, it's like a much quicker timeline than the first doc I did. But let me see. I was just sitting at home. It was December of 2022. I was sitting at home, and I got a text from a friend from Kansas City, and her son, who's like a big film buff, like we always talk about Yorgos Lanthimos films whenever we're around, his name's Aiden. She sent me an article about, you know, this chief superfan who had been arrested in Bixby, Oklahoma, and, you know, everyone thought he was a serial bank robber. And so I looked at it, and I was like, oh, this is super interesting. And then, you know, I went back to like, because, you know, at the time I was researching a bunch of projects to do next, and went back to like looking into this book thief doc that I've been wanting to do for a long time. And, you know, she sent me another one, and this time it was a video from Cole DeRoos, and I watched it. And he's Cole DeRoos does a YouTube channel called How About Those Chiefs. Mm-hmm. And I watched it, and like his reporting was awesome, like very in depth. You know, he fact checks like a mug, awesome. And I was like, oh, this is incredible. This is like the sports world meets crime. And then you have this other like human drama element where it's like he could be homeless, but he's a liar. And I was like, you know, whenever I do a film, I like to do a lot of investigating myself. And so it just felt like an avenue where I could combine filmmaking and investigating. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's when I decided to like type in, you know, find out where he was at, which he was at the Tulsa County Jail. And so I, you know, was surprised at how easily I could just send him an email. And then from there we got on the phone and, you know, I just asked him like, hey, if you get out on bail, like, I would love to film a documentary with you. And I knew it was like an eventuality he would get out on bail. You know, considering what was in the news and the reports and his lifestyle that he had put online. So it was just a matter of time. And then, you know, luck meets opportunity. We got to film with, you know, Xavier Babudar as mm-hmm. he got out on bail, and another story unfolded, you know, because I was more interested in like, oh, is he a serial bank robber? You know, because at the time everyone's like online, you know, like Pat McAfee and all kind of like the social media influencers of the NFL were like, yeah, this guy's a serial bank robber who, you know, robbed banks to do this lifestyle with the NFL. And mm-hmm. we didn't know that. People just said that. Yeah. And so I wanted to find that out if it were true. And yeah, he got out and a whole nother story developed, and it's pretty wild.
Yeah. And I'm glad you talked about like the word reporting and talked about Cole DeRoos and sort of this investigative approach. I know about your background, but why do you take this journalistic approach to your work? Like, what is it about that way of working, then also like things that you've done in your life that have kind of influenced that?
Well, I started off in news, TV news. Mm-hmm. I worked at KWWL, and kind of my baptism into documentaries was probably like a lot of modern filmmakers, as I watched the Thin Blue Line by Earl Morris. And I thought, you know, it was a doc, but it was also an investigation at the same time, telling the same story from multiple angles. And I really loved that. I thought that was, it's a specific skill set that someone has, that you have to be insanely obsessive to do things. And you know, that's one thing I got going for me, is I can become extremely obsessive about a subject and not stop and not stop. You know, in any other, I think, profession, that might actually be a bad thing, right? But in filmmaking, like, you can get away with just like being obsessed with one story for, you know, a number of years, and then just like trying to find all the intangibles around it and trying to find new information. Because one thing that I loved working at KWWL, as I started off as an editor and then I became a photog, which is what we now refer to as a videographer, is I loved breaking news, like finding out new things that no one had found out about.
Yep.
And so whenever, you know, you approach a documentary, it's like, well, what can I bring that's new to the story that nobody knows, that happened behind the scenes, you know, explanations for things that, you know, if you're just following the media reports or the news reports, there's all these underlying questions of like, why did it happen this way? What was the communications between, you know, these new news drops? And and I love that, you know, cause and effect. That's a big thing. And yeah, it's what attracts me to filmmaking.
That was a great answer. I mean, I'm not surprised by any of that. I think your personality really does jive with that approach really well. And
when, you know, I love chaos. So yeah.
Well, it's like organized chaos, because like you're finding pathways, and like I think pathways, not a pathway. I think that's what it interests me most about Chiefs, is that there wasn't really just one character. You were finding multiple plot lines and multiple pathways that led us to sort of the same conclusion, which I think was also done really well and taken together, which is your HBO miniseries you did with Christian Day also. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that research phase of the projects for you? Like, how do you, specifically with Chiefs, I feel, maybe I'm being too assuming here, but I feel like you knew more than the authorities did, like, before they knew. And, like, how did you go about piecing all that stuff together so quickly?
So, yeah, first thing I did when I knew I was going to be like trying to do a documentary. And there's like the one thing about being your own catalyst for a documentary filmmaker versus like someone who has to go in development is that no one can tell you no. Yeah. You can just like do it and you can do all the legwork and then get it to somewhere and then get the financing to finish it. And that makes you very dangerous as a filmmaker because you can make what you want to make versus like what someone's willing to give you money to develop. So, yeah. So for Xavier, I just like put in a data set. Once again, I had my brother Phoenix, who does a lot of stuff, you know, technology stuff is what I call it and joke with him, but he knows how to use Python and stuff like that. So I created a data set. First off, we mapped out, we scraped all of his tweets, before he had shut down his, Twitter. And I created a data set for robberies, you know, based upon the report in Bixby. And, you know, that was like, you know, the language that he used, which the FBI calls like forensic linguistics, you know, his body type, the clothes he was wearing, the time of day he went in. And so I took that data set and then I just looked for a bunch of different robberies, you know, that involved, you know, reported handgun jumping over the counter. And I was quickly able to find, I think it was three, and that was, no, it was four. I was quickly able to find four. It was, sure enough, it was the ones in Des Moines, West Des Moines, Clive, and then in Omaha, right? So that's three. So I found three. And they were just so similar that it was like, okay, he's from Kansas City. Here's a very rare type of robbery. Like most people who rob a bank, they do it with a banknote and they're in and out in like 15 seconds because the risk is so high of getting caught. So this guy jumped the counter with a gun and went to the vault and took the cash. That's like, that's some crazy shit, right? People don't do that nowadays. That's like what you see in movies, but never really happens. And so, you know, I was quickly able to be like, all right, there's a really high percentage chance that this could be Xavier. And so when I was talking to him about doing the documentary, my whole idea was like, I want to sit this guy down, you know, and you heard me say this in the car, you know, when we were filming, he was like, I want to sit this guy down, do like kind of a softball interview about his life. And at the very end, like show him 30 pictures of bank robberies. Right. And in the first 27 pictures or 26 pictures would be like easy, no brainer, like funny shit, like an old lady robbing a bank, you know, it's like a kind of like a gimmick. And then at the very end, throw him the ones from West Des Moines, Clive, Iowa, Omaha, where it's the same body type. It's the same MO. You know, same language to use and just catch his reaction like live. But I mean, you know, Xavier was a little too clever and never really, you know, he evaded our sit down, you know, cause we tried for a while to get Xavier to sit down and he wouldn't do it. So he would only let us like follow him, you know, and then he obviously flew the coop and we were like, I was like, oh shit, we don't have a doc. And Christian's like, well, now we have a new doc. And it took me a second to kind of reorient myself and be like, okay, it's a whole, you know, completely different film. And that's like the thing about filmmaking is and now you know this better than I do, it's like you have a plan and you think you're going to execute it and you're going to get stuff done because that's how films are funded, that's how they're made, is like you have a plan in place, you go execute the plan, you come back and you edit. When variables change, you have to rethink it because in order to get funding for a film, you kind of have to have almost the whole film envisioned at the beginning. You know, so when things change, it's like, oh, it's like throwing a wrench. You have to go back and reinvent the film. And that's a lot of work.
It's hard to sell a film that doesn't have a quote unquote ending.
It's very hard.
And I think that was something when Xavier left that you guys ran into, right? It was like, they're like, yeah, this is a great story, but where does it end?
It was like, what was it? Renzi would say, like, he went Kaiser Soze from what's that film? The Usual Suspects, where he just kind of disappears and. That's what I thought. He was like, went to Mexico when he ran. I was like, this guy, why wouldn't you? It's like disappearing to Mexico, never to be found again. So I was surprised when he was caught in California.
And when he was on the lam, you guys were with Michael.
Yeah, Michael Lloyd. Yeah,
Michael Lloyd bail bonds most of the time. And can you kind of talk about that portion of the doc? Because I think that was one that you know, it was just you and Christian kind of living in a car with Michael, in and out of hotels, eating fast food, yeah. kind of being almost like staking it out, you know, like
yeah, we
being
were.
Investigators.
So like the first time I talked to Michael Lloyd on the phone, because I had gotten his number from Xavier's mom, because Xavier's mom had called a bunch of bail bondsmen because she was trying to get Xavier bailed out. So the first time I talked to him on the phone, because I wanted to be like, hey, we think this is happening. He's going to, you know, and you might be doing this, doing the bail. I was like, can we film this? Mm-hmm. Like, this would be, you know, for a filmmaker to be behind the scenes while someone's getting bailed is like, you want to film the process, right?
Yeah.
Even if you don't use it in the film. And so I remember the first time I was going to talk to him on the phone, like my leg was shaking. It was like, I've never talked to a bail bondsman before. Mm-hmm. He's probably mean as shit. You know, he's going to be like, hell no. Absolutely not. Why am I even talking to you? Click. But he wasn't. He was like the nicest guy I'd ever talked to on the phone. And I think we talked for like an hour or 90 minutes the first time I talked to him on the phone. And we didn't even really talk about Xavier. We talked about like lots of other stuff about, you know, what was going on in politics, what, you know, crypto, you know, he's like really big into NFTs too. And he was just the nicest guy. So it kind of took me, you know, it kind of just threw me off my guard and, was really gracious. I was really happy, and he was gracious enough to let us film the whole process. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just a wild character. And so when Xavier ran, and you know, we were basically living in a car with him for like 3 weeks, the first initial, you know, filming block was like, I think 2.5 weeks. You know, you find out how boring it is to look for someone. It's super boring. Mm-hmm. But then you have these pockets of excitement where things are happening and you think like, oh, this could be it. Get ready. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, it's not. Damn.
Yeah. Well, you guys did a great job with that. Cause like you kind of alluded to, you have to be super patient in those moments and just sit in a car for like 10 hours a day with your finger on the button, ready to record.
If I have somebody, the cash, got yeah. the 45 second cash button.
Yeah. Right? Pre-record.
So pre-record. Yeah. So yeah.
Did you, and it's weird because I bet you probably never envisioned the film going that direction. So you like that pivot. Can you talk about like that mental sort of pivot you had to do with the film sort of changing? Cause I think with us having access to Xavier, it was like a completely different film than yeah. when we didn't. Right.
When you didn't, it was like, well, now we're following. Well, it was actually Andrew Renzi, you know, we had actually, you know, I'd gotten a text or a call from Michael Lloyd, you know, saying that Xavier had run. Mm-hmm. And I was like, bullshit. And he's like, no, this is for real. So I called Christian right away and we headed down to Kansas City because that's where Michael Lloyd was heading. And we're in Des Moines and he's in Tulsa because he's following the mother and the brother mm-hmm. because he had, you know, put a tracking device on their car. And it's just like to him, it's like, oh, Xavier, he just got a message from Tulsa County. Xavier cut off his ankle monitor. He looks at his app where he's tracking the Ford Flex and it's like, it's going up to Kansas City. Mm-hmm. So it's like extremely suspicious, you know? So it's like, he's got to follow them because he yeah. thought Xavier was with him. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, he's gone. And then, you know, Carla and Noah took off, you know, north. Yeah. So
what else would you do but follow them?
Yeah. What else would you do? And we knew, you know, like that was one thing about Xavier. Every time we were with him, he talked about his family.
Yeah.
Like, you remember that? Like every single time, everything he would, you know.
It was the first thing he wanted to do when he got out of jail.
Like, family, mm-hmm. family, family. His mother and his brother, family, family. And then, it was like the Chiefs and stuff like that. And yeah, just wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of wild, I think there's, in the film, there's a couple of sort of central characters. Once, you know, Xavier was caught in California, brought back to Kansas City for, you know, to be tried for his crimes, he had a lawyer.
Oh, yeah, Matthew Merriman.
Matthew Merriman. Yeah. And can you talk about Matthew Merriman as, like, one of the characters? Because I feel like he ended up being, like, a pretty central character in the film,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So after he was caught in Sacramento in July of 2023, right, we thought the film was over, mm-hmm. right? We had this moment of Michael Lloyd, you know, he pays the bond forfeiture in the morning. Later that day, they catch him. Mm-hmm. So he's going to get his money back. We're like, dang, that's our film.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And then like a month later, Matthew Merriman, his Xavier's new attorney, comes down in front of the, what is it, the federal courthouse in Kansas City, and he does that football metaphor, you know, about Xavier and, you know,
the pocket collapsing.
Well, that's the that's the second one he does. What was it after his plea deal, after he decided to plea? But it was the first one that he said, it was like, this is not Chiefsaholic's last drive, you know, like, and, I was like, oh my God, like another wild character. I was like, we have to include him in the story. And, so after that, it took some months, but yeah, we got him to sit down and interview and got to get behind the scenes on a lot of stuff, and very gracious to him for that, you know, cause for, you know, the way I kind of look at filmmaking, or at least documentary, is like, whenever you're interviewing someone or following someone, they're kind of inheriting all the risk, because they're giving you access to their personal life, to which they have no editorial choice over.
Yeah.
Right. So I try to, you know, I don't take that lightly. So.
Yeah. And I think people's perception of them is important to at least consider, and like, you want to put them out in the best light you can. And I think another group of characters that you did a great job with in the film was the super fans.
Oh, yeah.
And can you kind of talk about them as a character, and like what it was like to work with them, and, you know, sort of like learn more about Chief's Kingdom throughout the film too?
Yeah. Let me see. Yeah, they're all wild. I mean, you have to shout out Weird Wolf for like hooking us up with a lot of these people. So because he was kind of the first initial person that we reached out to, and then he put us in touch with like Fidel and, you know, Daniel Nelson, rest in peace, Daniel Nelson, and who else was there, you know, Shaggy Shane, you know, a bunch of different people. So, you know, he's got a lot of credibility amongst the fans in Kansas City. And so shout out to Weird Wolf. But I think I was like on Google, and I was like doing the thing you never do, where you like, you Google your film, and because you're kind of trying to read reviews, and you know, like when you type in the name and it has like suggested questions that people are asking about the film. I remember seeing the question, like, is the Chiefsaholic documentary real? And I thought that was hilarious. And I think it's a testament to all the characters in the film, because they're all so different and larger than life and unique. And, you know, when you watch the film, you're like, is this real? Like, are these people real? And I was like, yeah, 100%. All these people are real.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, that's just who they are. Right. And, you know, normally in documentaries, like, it's hard to get colorful people to like be themselves on camera, because to have a camera in front of your face is probably one of the most clinical, dissective, you know, experiences you can have in your life most of the time. And all these people were just like, don't give a shit. I am who I am.
Yeah.
You know, and it like, you know, that really blew me away, you know. And I think that's just maybe something inherent in football, that people are just like, they don't care. They just are who they are. And, yeah, just a lot of characters. And, that was one thing that, you know, we all tried to capture, you, you know, cause the first filming day that we did remember was the AFC Championship game against the Bengals. And we just did like man on the street stuff, walking up to people, asking about Chiefsaholic. And it was like, I wanted to give a taste to someone who doesn't know football or sports. And I know football is the most popular sport in America, but there's a lot of people who don't watch it. And when you make a film, you make it for everyone, right? Even people, you know, not in the United States. It was like, give them a taste of like, you know, the tailgate.
Yeah.
Of the culture of fans, of fandom, of super fans, and what it's like. And it's like, to me, it's very romantic, the love you have for a football team, for a city, you know, for the players, you know, it's very romantic. And, you know, it's something you can easily get wrapped up in yourself. And I did too, because I was a fan of the Kansas City Chiefs. And then after this doc, I'm like even a bigger fan of the Chiefs. You know, I'm like, oh, what's going up on this draft? You know, like I'm all into that now. Like, oh, what's the next draft? Who are we getting? Yeah, it's like, is it really that important? No, but, you know, for some reason, man, it hooked me.
Yeah, I mean, I like that you said it was romantic. I mean, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about fandom and sport, and specifically in the United States, right? Like, people kind of can rip on us or we rip on each other for being so obsessed with sports. But like, when you think about what sports really are, like, it appeals to our like DNA. It appeals to our sense of tribalism and
modern day gladiator.
Yeah, exactly. So it makes complete sense that it's like that. I think it's what was interesting about this doc was really exploring the extremity of that, you know, and like what you said about the superfans, though, they're pretty normal people.
Mm-hmm.
They just happen to put face paint on and dress up and be crazy about a team.
Well, it was, I think Weird Wolf said, and I thought this was very interesting, and it didn't make it into the film. But, you know, when we asked him, like, what is a superfan? You know, he went through, like, you know, it's someone who's obsessed with their team. But, you know, he said, you know, they're leaders of the crowd. Like, they consider, like, when they go to the game, super fans are leaders of the crowd.
Yeah.
Like, they know if they can get the crowd loud during third and long for the opposing team, they're going to make communication harder on the field for the team to get their, you know, their play in order, and they could affect the game. And that's
which
what
the Chiefs, they do.
Which they do, and that's what they're, what, that's what they're going for. And I was like, oh, wow. So it's like, it just added an extra dimension to like what a super fan was when they consider themselves a leader of the crowd.
Yeah. And like, just for reference, for people that do not know this, the Kansas City Chiefs have the recorded loudest crowd in the history of recorded crowds.
Yeah. It's like 140 some decibels.
Yeah. And one of their phrases that Lynn Weird Wolf uses sometimes is decibel up. Doesn't he have a keychain?
He's got a keychain.
A necklace. Yeah, a necklace. Mm-hmm. And so they really do, like, they are a part of this team, and even so much so that the team recognizes that, I think. They talk about it in the media sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, we're so proud of it. They are proud of it.
Like, it's the loudest stadium in the world.
Yeah, it makes their job easier on defense sometimes, you know. You can get those false start calls, you know, and when that happens, like, the crowd is actually making a difference in the game, which is something that doesn't happen everywhere. Yeah. Not every stadium is like that. Yeah. I mean, hate them or love them, Chiefs Kingdom is a special breed of fan, and they and the Chiefs are an extremely successful organization. So I think to really be close to that and like be able to dive in deeper to that was fascinating. Did you find yourself?
We could have done like a whole 90-minute doc just on
super fans,
like just those super people. Fans, yeah, like the Kansas City Chiefs super fans.
I mean, there'd be a doc on Weird Wolf alone. What a cool dude! I mean, just like he's
absolutely
been like one of the OGs from a long time ago, and has, I think, is a great steward of the game and a great steward of super fandom. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, he holds himself to a high regard. Yeah. A lot of them do.
Yeah,
which is another reason why this doc was so interesting, because you had them, and then you had Xavier, who, it's not that, you know, you can't really say that he held himself to the same standard as someone as like Lynn, because he did what he did, right? But the juxtaposition of those people and seeing that in two different lights was fascinating.
Yeah,
to see
one road, the other road.
Exactly.
I don't know. You know, I can't see why someone would go rob banks to be a part of, you know, a family of fans. Like I don't see it, but when you put in, you know, the data set that Xavier probably came from, or that we know of that he came from, it makes sense why that he would do anything he could do to be a part of that family, or to be as high up in that family as he could possibly be. Yeah, because it's pretty
made
wild.
It feel good.
Pretty awesome. Yeah. And I, you know, I went to my first Chiefs game right before I started filming this, and I've went to 3 cents,
like, including the coldest game.
Including the coldest game, the Dolphins and Chiefs game, was it the wild card round in 2023, I think. But it's wild walking into Arrowhead's like walking into the Coliseum to some degree. You know, it's like, you know, I'm just from Iowa, so it's like the biggest stadium I ever walked into, I think, was like the West High, or was it Central? Central had a stadium there, so it was pretty cool. Going to a professional football game is pretty wild, pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's an energy for sure. And and I think one thing that I've talked about, like when I've been talking about Chiefs with people, that I am like continually blown away by is just how the edit came together and how energetic the edit is and how great of a job you and Alex Emmeling did.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Emmeling.
Mm-hmm. How did that portion of the process go? Like, how often did you guys talk and like also, like, were you, just for clarification to start, you were given Final Cut by Amazon?
Oh, no, no, that's, you know, no. Most people in the film industry don't get Final Cut. You're like big names, or you're, I don't know, you'd call them legacy directors. Mm-hmm. Like, they get Final Cut. But us Padawans, small guys, like, you don't get that. But you don't need it. Like,
yeah.
You're trying to make a great film. Mm-hmm. And so, like, and so is Amazon. And so, like, all their the notes they gave to us, or, you know, from Renzi, or you know, from North of Now, or Dream Crew, or mm-hmm. Amazon, were all great notes.
Yeah.
They made the movie better.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's like your job to establish, like, what you're doing, what are you putting forward first? And for us, it was like always the story. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do like documentaries as like characters or story. Like, what are you putting at the forefront? I guess we had like a 4-hour version of the film, like the first cut. Mm-hmm. But it was like character was kind of like the top and most important thing. And, you know, we had to like make story the most important thing. And
yeah.
That's why you switch out of, you know, your time jumping, is because the story is the main character of the film. Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah. Most directors don't get director's cut, and I don't think you really need it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like you ran.
If you're working with terrible people, maybe, but you know, yeah, we were working with awesome people.
Yeah. So. It's not like you're running into roadblocks and having to have arguments or anything. You were,
no,
it was all
no
professional and cohesive, and you guys were on the same page. So it's like, you don't need to fight for those things that don't need to be fought for.
Before you sell the film, you give them, you know, like
your
outline of the film. Mm-hmm. So it's like,
and they were behind you the whole time.
Yeah.
Which is amazing to me. Yeah. Like, because I think coming from like an independent level, you look at these really large production companies and you're like, oh, what's it like to work with them? And like, what was it like to work with Dream Crew and North of Now and Amazon? I mean, I bet you learned a shit ton working with
yeah,
them.
Yeah, I absolutely did. But I mean, it was honestly, like, there was never really any problems at all. It was, you know, it was like, if you do the work, right, mm-hmm. then it's, you get the notes. Some of the notes you, I wouldn't say you ignore, but like, you don't have to do every single note that you're ever given when you're doing a film. You do mm-hmm. the ones that you can do, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because like the director has like the idealized finished version of the film. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you have to keep that as your North Star.
Yeah.
And that way the film is still good and still feels like it comes from a singular vision versus like a collective vision.
Yeah.
Which I've always found that the filmmakers I like, or the documentary filmmakers I like, they come from like a singular vision.
And I think
can't really think of very many films that come from a collective vision that are awesome. I'm sure there is, but you know, you just try to make the film that you want to see, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
And that cohesiveness, like, why I ask that question is because I think I want people to know that exact what you said. Like, if you have a plan and you have that outline in the bigger industry, like, there's not going to be issues that people think there might be. Like, this is about, like, you said it really eloquently, which is they want to put out a good film just like you did. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a misconception that lower sort of rungs of filmmaking, they sort of look at studios in a negative light sometimes. And I don't think that's helpful, because I think eventually everybody's going to want to get to that level. Right. And
most of the people working at these studios were once independent filmmakers.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
It's like, you know, they know what you're trying to do. They know the mm-hmm. films, right? Like,
and they were super supportive of your vision too, mm-hmm. I think.
100%.
I mean, like, just to put it in reference, like, I'll go back to what you said. You delivered a 4-hour cut to them and they weren't, like, shocked. They're like, this is a great start.
Technically, the first cut of the film was 2 hours and, like, 52 minutes. But I would say you know, because you have your your narrative breakdown, whatever, you know, so the build out of the film was 4 hours.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it a cut because, you know, we were still missing a lot of footage or mm-hmm. archive materials, but it was 3 hours and 52 minutes, and we still hadn't interviewed Peyton Garcia, and we still hadn't filmed all the stuff with Matthew Merriman. So it would have been, the proper build out would have been 4 hours, but that's just a build out. That's before you start to tear it down and mm-hmm. like get it along. And that's just, I think, because I just overdid my job, because I investigate the shit out of stuff and I love the details. And yeah, you know, did not expect that you know, when you get your belt out of the film, it was 4 hours. You're like, oh shit.
So how did you, how did you do it with Alex to get it down?
Oh, so we had the build out at 4 hours, and then we had our first rough cut due to Amazon and a week. So we had to cut it from, was it 3 hours and 53 minutes? We had to cut it down below 3 hours for the first cut to Amazon. Mm-hmm. 'Cause you don't want to deliver a 4 hour cut.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that. So, yeah. We were able to do it in a week, which actually was probably the easiest cut down. Hmm. Right. 'Cause there's just a lot
of stuff. But from there, it was more difficult. The cut downs from there.
I would say once we got like down, when we were like at 220, cutting it down to 220 to 2 hours was 2 hours to 2 hours and 10 minutes was tough. And then the last 10 minutes, was pretty tough. Yeah. It took a while.
Yeah.
And then at the very end of it, you can like nip and tuck like a minute or two out of it, just with like getting rid of like little pauses and stuff throughout mm-hmm. the film. But I myself like the flow, of a film that doesn't, I mean, the film has a lot of energy mm-hmm. and I think that comes down, it comes from just cutting down and cutting down and cutting down to just like, you know, it's like doing a balsamic reduction, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you just keep distilling the, wild though to think that we had a 4 hour cut. And I was like, damn, what idiot would try to make a 4 hour film?
Well, like you said, I think you just did so much investigating that I don't think people usually go that thorough or go that deep, even with like B-roll. Like, holy shit, like you filmed so many inserts for the film. Like, mm-hmm. can you talk about that approach where you're like, we had to use archival, obviously, of like football games and newscasts and stuff like that. But like you filmed most of the inserts in the movie, right? Like the screens, the money.
Yeah, most of the screenshots on there that have like the CRT look or the pixelated look. Yeah, we shot ourselves on a monitor at the office.
Yeah.
Right.
Probe lens, a lot of it or no?
Yep, probe lens. Was it the Laowa?
Yeah.
I think it's the Laowa one. But yeah, probe lensed it.
And then I mean, would spend like time doing that in post, like adding that effect on in post.
We did some stuff like because we couldn't get all of it. Some of it was in effect and we had a great digital effects team, or what do you call them, a graphics team that did a really nice job. But yeah, a lot of it we just did right in house, like, you know, used a probe lens to shoot the money. My favorite films are usually always as much as they can be custom everywhere at every nook and cranny. Mm-hmm. So did it for this film as much as we could, which I think it's, you know, about 99% of it's custom.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you also, speaking of custom and also thinking about this, like one person taking the approach of the film from start to finish, you also did the score for Chief Zahlik. Mm-hmm. What was like your overall approach for the music? Like, what were you hoping to accomplish with the score that you created?
I've never been asked that, but,
even if it's just a feeling, like,
yeah, I just wanted the film to feel lonely and grand at the same time. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then also like a little enterprising too. Just was like, you know, it's like a piano line that just like keeps playing over and over again. And then the chord changes around just the piano line. You know, we had Pat Riley, who's a guy here from Des Moines, do the strings too, who's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Always brings amazing ideas and flooded it with some better sophistication than I could and nuance. But yeah, just wanted to feel lonely and grand at the same time, because mm-hmm. we have this, I feel like that's kind of like that's kind of Xavier.
Yeah.
Like, from what we met him, he's like this grand individual who seems insanely lonely.
Yeah, that's well said. I think it also provides like a pace,
mm-hmm.
An up and down pace to the movie, the film, that where is really interesting, because there's some times where it feels like there's a ticking clock, mm-hmm. and it really gets into your subconscious to where you are sitting watching the film and you feel your heart beating faster. Mm-hmm. It's almost like dictates how the heart rate of the audience.
There's only a couple parts in the film that actually have the ticking time clock, but once you start that in a film, it makes it feels like everything's like ticking off to a bomb. Mm-hmm. It's weird how that works, but
yeah, there's,
that's also just Alex editing, who's just a monster of an editor. Awesome.
Oh yeah. The pace was just, it felt like, it feels very like authentic to sport and to like the highlight reel and like the pace of like how watching a sporting event can feel, especially mm-hmm. if you like distill it down into a highlight reel. Mm-hmm. Like they only put the best plays in a highlight reel. So mm-hmm. if you watch that like 9 minute recap of an NFL game, it's pretty intense for 9 minutes.
Yeah.
And that also reminded me personally of like how Xavier was when we watched the Super Bowl with him. I mean, yeah, I tell people this a lot. Like I've been to like bigger sporting events. I've been to an NFL playoff game in Pittsburgh. I've been to NHL Stanley Cup finals games in Pittsburgh. Neither of those equated to the level of energy that was in that hotel room when Xavier was watching that Super Bowl.
Yeah, that was, I just, oh yeah, I remember I just remember feeling so sad, like when we were filming that, because it's like, here's this guy and he's rooting for this team. It's like, dude is going to jail. You know, like you mm-hmm. want to give people the presumption of innocence, even in cases where it's 99.9% chance they did it, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's always that outlier event that's like, oh, wait, everything's twisted and wrong. And, you know, at the time you don't know. So you don't want to like abandon this core principle of presumption of innocence. You never want to do that. But in the back of your mind, you're like, all right, this guy did it, right? Mm-hmm. And here he is just like going crazy at this game. And he thinks he's won this money that's going to take care of his family. And he just seems someone who's like a little bit out of touch with what's coming to him a little bit, you know. And that's not to like make him to be a good person or anything, you know. You know, what he did to the bank tellers was terrible and terrified people. I remember we got some of the discovery files from some of the bank robberies, and, you know, some of the pictures in there are close-ups of people's skin where he had bruises or impressions from where he put his fake gun, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you see a guy that big, he looks like he could play professional football, run up on you, jump over a counter and start yelling at you in a bank. It's terrifying. I'm assuming it's absolutely terrifying. So I'm not trying to say he's a good person or whatever, but at the time, you know, we were operating on the assumption that like, hey, there might be more to this story. Mm-hmm. It's most likely that he's guilty. But you don't really want to abandon the principle of presumption of innocence, even though it's, in this case, it seems like kind of moot. But so I just was like, I was sad for him because I was like, this guy, you know, he's probably going to jail for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And he is just obsessed with this game and he's won these bets. He thinks he's going to take care of his family. And I'm just like, you know, at the time I thought, you know, the court's going to come and they're going to take that cash from you, man.
Yeah.
Or you're going to get sued from one of the bank tellers and they're going to take that cash from you. Like, you haven't saved your mother and your brother yet,
yeah,
like he thought, you know. But yeah, that's, it's a real life uncut gems, you know, in that room with him.
Yeah, and the whole time there's this like, and you even asked it in your questions to our interview people, is this a tragedy or a comedy? Because mm-hmm. it just fluctuated so quickly between those feelings, where 1 second you're kind of like, oh, this is ridiculous. And then you're like, oh, but there's real life people at stake here and their mm-hmm. lives and their livelihood and their mental well-being. And the stakes of this film for me, like even as a viewer, were so high. And I think especially with like getting Peyton's interview, that really showed those stakes in a different way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's the about face in the film, right? That's like where it... Because like when we first met Xavier, he walked up, he's this big guy, he's kind of goofy, he's got a high-pitched voice, he's got braces, but he's big and he's muscular and he's imposing. So he's like a walking contradiction, mm-hmm. right? And you're like, oh, he's kind of disarming in a way, right? He kind of takes you back and you're like, well, maybe this guy isn't who people are saying he is on the internet, right? You know, mm-hmm. he's well-spoken, he's intelligent, you know, he's very well mannered,
and he's so you're kind, yeah.
Yeah, he's very kind. So you're just like, what? Like, you were like, what? You know, it doesn't gel with like what people are saying. So you're like, maybe there is this, you know, possibility that he's innocent, even though it's like that would be crazy. But at the time, you don't know. You just don't know, right? So, but then, you know, when we sat down with Peyton Garcia and she told the story, and it was, you know, obviously that would be super traumatic and scary. And, but, you know, she seemed to be a real trooper. And, you know, if I had to sum up her interview, she had a lot of grace.
She did.
Because she could have been so ticked off and wished the worst for someone, but she wasn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had a lot of grace, you know, and I think she just had a lot of grace.
Yeah. She did a wonderful job and with recounting a traumatic event. And I think in some way, I think she kind of knew that that was important, whether or not she knew it in the time, but like what she did wasn't easy, but it was important for the film, I think, to
Absolutely.
Give it really like an even balance. At its core, you spent so much time with this film. Is there something that really sticks out to you as like the central theme of this film, like an idea, a phrase?
You know, kind of like what you had said before, like kind of the over the top line or the highfalutin idea that's, you know, above the film while you're watching it, as much as you try to put subtext into films. But, you know, is Xavier's story a comedy or a tragedy, right? Because it's got, you know, all these sensational aspects to it that would make it a comedy, right? Like, but at the same time, beneath it, you have a, you know, someone who grew up basically homeless and then, you know, did a lot of bad things to provide for a lifestyle, or, you know, to provide for his family, to gamble, to do, again, lots of bad things, you know, like, so it's like, it's got elements of a comedy, elements of a tragedy. So like, what is it? Right. You know, because at the end of the day, you know, he affected a lot of human beings' lives and he is a human being himself. So, you know, it's weird how like there was some Shakespearean element to his story, right? You know, like, that's something I did not think would be when we first started filming this, that element would not be in the film, but, you know, it was 100%. A friend of mine sent me a picture of a tweet that said, like, I don't know who these filmmakers, like, if they feel bad for this guy or they hate him, right? Like, someone had tweeted that. And I was like,
that's awesome.
Yeah. It was like,
that's a great compliment.
My opinion about the story doesn't matter, right? But my job is to go get all the elements as best I can, as many as people, and talk to as many people as possible to give the viewer, like, the most objective look at this and then not try to tip the scales, right? Because it's complicated, life's complicated. You know, if I didn't like the gray areas, I wouldn't be a filmmaker, or you wouldn't be a good filmmaker if you don't like the gray areas, because that's where all the nuance of great stories comes from, is like the gray area. So yeah, it was just like, don't put your thumb on the scale. Your opinion doesn't really matter, right? You're just a conduit for the story, you know. And, you know, by being a conduit, what you select and what you don't select, kind of, you can easily tip the scales. So it's like, you always have to be balanced in what you end up including and what you end up excluding. And that's a tough, delicate balance. Luckily, you know, had a great editor, Alex. And me and Alex would talk like almost every day. It got to the point where he's like, dude, I can't get that much work done, because we're talking for like 90 minutes every morning. And it was, you know, I get, like I said at the top of this, I get obsessed with stuff and I love it. And I just, you know, want to make the best possible version of what you're trying to make, and, you know, and then people will decide if it's good or not. But, you know, it's like, no one's ever going to say like, oh man, they didn't work hard enough on that film. You know, like, it's like, they may not agree with the creative approach or something like that, and that's cool, that's fine. But it's like, you're never not going to get it, you know, get the filmmaking team, you know, for not working hard enough. It's like, because we go for it, you know, try to get every last ounce of story that we can, you know. It's like, keep that camera rolling. It's like, you're tired. It's like, been a long day. Just keep rolling. It's like, you could get this moment. And most of the time you don't, right? So you do 99% of this work that never even makes it into the film, but you're doing it for that 1% of the time, that one outlier event where it's like, oh, we got it, you know? Just got to keep rolling.
That was my conversation with director Dylan Sires, and now we'll move on to part two of my conversation with producer Christian Day. This was a pretty personal project for you because you were thrown into like investigative reporter role, right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I signed off the other night when, because Dylan and I were within like the first like 24, 48 hours of the film drop. I think it was like Christmas night. He and I were texting back and forth each other. And it was weird because that was the first time Dylan ever texted me good night. Really weird. And I didn't know how to respond except I said, good night, Inspector Sires.
That's a great title for him because he really is like an investigative reporter.
He is an investigative reporter. And that's something that like I can appreciate because that's not me. Mm-hmm. And
except for a few weeks in March.
Yeah, well, yeah, that. The project itself, when you say it's per, it was per, it wasn't, to me, it wasn't going to be a personal project. It became a personal project. And I guess you kind of breadcrumb that with the, in March of last year or March of 2023, when the main subject, Xavier Babadar, decided to cut his ankle monitor and go on the lam. And I was told, I got a call from Dylan on a Saturday night at like 9 o'clock that he had cut his ankle monitor an hour ago. So like 8 o'clock. And then I had to find a camera operator at 9 o'clock at night in Tulsa to go meet Michael Lloyd, the bail bondsman, to go into that hotel room and shoot him like searching the room.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really tricky. And then obviously like packing up our stuff and what we could take to go to Kansas City, me and Dylan, to meet Michael Lloyd, because now we're going to go search for the family. Mm-hmm. And are following the tracking of this, the mm-hmm. hunt. And we had no more development money. Development money, faucet turned off. And so everything now is coming out of my own pocket.
And this is you and Dylan taking your cameras, your equipment, your cars, yep. going down.
Yep. And for 2 weeks, following the family, because coincidentally, the night that he cut his ankle monitor off and fled, his family also left Tulsa towards Kansas City.
So alarming.
Alarming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, alarming. And I remember when we finally got to Kansas City, we found the family parked in an empty lot and in a car, in their car, which was a black Ford Flex with the darkest tint windows. I mean, which I can't believe that any state has not, like the police have just not pulled them over for how dark their windows are tinted, because mm-hmm. I had bought a car.
I've been pulled over,
yeah. And I bought a used car that just happened to be just a hair darker than it should have been in the state of Iowa,
mm-hmm.
and I'm pulled off on I-35. These people, you can see in my car. You cannot see inside this car.
And it's just for the viewers. It's because they are living inside.
They are living inside their car. And I remember we pulled into this lot, and we saw them. And I remember we pulled down into this this like empty business lot, and we're watching, and we couldn't tell if they could see us or not. And that mm-hmm. was like some, and at this point there's still so much mystery surrounding the family. So we didn't know if they were dangerous. We didn't know any of that stuff. And I remember at one point we're like, hey, we should probably reposition. We're not getting a good view.
Mm-hmm.
So I turned the car on and I turned on the lights, and there was like 100 raccoons just like chilling. And I was like, oh, this is not great. And we pull up there. I mean, the raccoons scared the hell out of me. But so we go up, we park in the parking lot, and I'm just going to sleep or something. Dylan's getting his binoculars out, mm-hmm. you know, and he's like, you know, Inspector Gadget, you know,
yeah.
watching. And we sat on that car for 16 hours.
Wow.
Waiting and waiting and waiting. And that was really the summary of all that. But like that those 2 weeks of following them around, you know, because he cut his ankle monitor on a Saturday night. It wasn't until 9 or 10 a.m., no, it was 11 a.m. officially on Monday, that they actually put a warrant out for his arrest.
Which is probably on his behalf planned.
Yeah.
Knowing that state governments and local governments sort of shut down on the weekends and might give him 48 hours to get farther, right?
Yeah.
Because he's not – the thing is about Xavier is like there's some intelligence there for sure that – some cunning criminal mind.
I mean,
there.
He could have gotten to the border if he wanted to.
Yeah.
He easily could have.
Yeah.
Nope. He went to, I mean, he ended up going to Vegas and then to Sacramento. He bought a car with cash. He robbed two banks and made his way to Sacramento.
But it was like a moving target from the start till kind
yeah,
of the
and
end.
Moving target projects are not ideal. I mean, that's why, like, even Taken Together took forever to sell because it was an open case.
Yeah.
And you're waiting for things to develop, and when things pop, then you go and interview and get the response. And that's great when you're in a position, but you really shouldn't be in that position when you have a studio deal and there's people on payroll and all that, because, like, it's impossible, and you'll blow through money.
The budget gets inflated
quickly. It gets really inflated, and you can't control it, and you don't know what you're going to be doing. I mean, most projects, most unscripted or doc, or we'll say doc in general, are done 10 – you have 10 days of shooting.
Mm-hmm.
You have 10 days. It's a done story. You're just getting everyone. You have 10 days to do it. It's not this. Like, we did close – I would say if you don't count the development time, which is about, I don't know how many, we shot for like 3 weeks, original development. We had about an additional 20 days of shooting that we did after Amazon got on board.
Yeah.
So that is.
You guys did at least 50 shoot dates.
Yeah. Yes. At least 50. And normally in those situations, it really should just be 2, maybe 3 people to get it done. And sometimes those people need to just be on a project rate versus a day rate or whatever, because you just can't control. There's so much you can't control. But we're in a position, I think, that is kind of unheard of in the industry, where you can send 2 to 3 people that can literally do every single job and capture it and capture it well. That's not the industry in the Los Angeles market.
No,
at all.
But that's, I mean, I have to sing your guys' praises for a second, which is you guys really were able to stretch the budget in a way that, like, there was never a, me as a DP, when I came to Dylan and you and were like, hey, I think Dylan and I talked about a Steadicam, and I'm like, I think we need Steadicam. You guys made it work. And we had a crew that, you know, I don't think in the bigger markets we could have stretched it that far. We could have got that much out of the crew. And sure, there were some tough days, some long days. But, like, can you talk about, like, how the crew sort of helped that happen? And you and Dylan's approach as far as, like, getting as much as we can out of these runs where we went to Kansas City and we went to Tulsa.
I think we all knew each other. That's one thing. You can't really do that with strangers, and you really can't ask that of strangers. I think there was a camaraderie that we developed early on and during development, where we all would be in an Airbnb together. And normally, if you're in hotel rooms, you're not having conversations about the shoot with your comrades because they're done and they're in their rooms and they're isolated.
We talked about the project constantly.
Yeah, we were constantly talking about it. And again, that is not a scenario for everyone, and not everyone is going to be about that. I think you have to work with, like, a group of friends that are cool with just talking about it and discussing it. I mean, because if some people, you know, this is a very long stretch of saying, but exaggerated. Some people are like, well, oh, am I on the clock? Am I on the clock right now? You know what I mean? If you don't know them.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of discussions we were able to have that we wouldn't have, I don't think we would have had otherwise, and be able to plan things out.
All those discussions in the car ride down to Tulsa.
All, I guess, 6 hours of talking about how we were going to shoot this.
That's where for me, with my talks with you and Dylan in those van rides, that's where the film was made for me. Like, that's how I got into it and was able to, like,
100%, 100%.
Do my job.
And then having people who are multi-skilled that, you know, that, like, on the production side, if Bridget was PA and she was also doing some prop stuff and
driving
things like
us.
That, driving yeah. us.
Everyone did multiple things.
Yeah, yeah. And then if there's a wild scenario where you couldn't come or something, being able to, like, Gabby and Dylan can manage camera, which was wild to see, you know. But that also, those are the situations that breed new people into this industry, because that's sort of like a baptism by fire.
Yeah, and a lot of people got that on this. Like,
they
this,
did.
For a lot of people who worked on this, this was the mm-hmm. biggest project they've ever worked
and
on.
And to be able to work on a project like that, everyone got paid for it, and to have it be released at such a high level, that's like a really nice thing for them.
Dream project
for them, because then when they see it, because this was a 2-year movie,
mm-hmm.
it was a 2-year movie, and a lot of things have happened to all of us in these last 2 years. A lot of things have changed for everyone, and some of this has been trying on personal relationships and whatever, and then to see what they made and know it's going to be out there is like a big thing for people.
It's huge because a lot of what we do, we make these projects, we make these films, and then 100 people show up to a screening, or 500 people see it at 3 film festivals, yep. or it goes online and gets 1200 views and it's done. This yep. was different because the platform has built in, you know, Thursday Night Football, yep. 10 million viewers see the trailer.
Yep. And then what they did last week, or during Christmas time, they had football, and then it automatically played right afterwards.
Which is, from my experience, dozens of people reached out to me and said, oh, yeah, this just played after a game I watched, and I ended up watching the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. That shows, A, for all those people that, like, this is like a, for younger people who are just starting out, it is a great career move to work on a project like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that means a lot. So, I mean, and it was like there's quite a few people that were not in the field with us, you know, who were assisting. But I will say, and I don't mind saying this, is like the majority of the work in the field was on the producing side was myself and Dylan.
Yep.
Figuring it out and using our resources.
Mm-hmm.
And it does benefit. I know there's directors who have never done camera, and he's very comfortable with shooting himself too.
Exactly. Which was a huge help.
Huge help. And I think he like, and I mean, I know he likes doing it.
Yeah. So with Chiefsaholic, is this the biggest project you've ever worked on? Like with the largest audience?
That's a hard one. Cause I mean, we had a huge audience for Queen of Meth.
Mm-hmm. What network was our streaming?
It was Discovery. It's on HBO Max as well now.
Oh, so huge, yeah.
Yeah. That one, because, you know, Tom Arnold and Lori Arnold, Tom's in it, obviously, and it's about his sister, Lori. That was in, like, I mean, the reviews for that were, like, in, there was, like, People Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were some pretty big trade reviews in that.
Okay.
And I was brought on as a production manager, and I got moved. Well, I always held on to that title, but then I also took on a field producer title on that. Mm-hmm. And then I was also heavily involved with the music supervising on that, and because they wanted music from that area. And cool. with Iowa Basement Tapes.
Which is like your thing.
Yeah, I was like, I got an 80s hair metal band that played at the bar that Lori Arnold owned in 1986. And even got one of the band members to be on camera. And we got a song synced up. It's actually the closing song for all 3 episodes, called Dead Men Get No Tails by a band called Rose, R-O-Z-E.
Sometimes you're the perfect person.
Yeah, I'm like, I got you. And then the biggest thing on top of that was they synced up 3 songs from one of my favorite Iowa bands from Ottumwa, Captain Three Leg.
Yeah.
And I brought Andy Kettle down to meet the director, and those two just like rapped for a little while. And he was like, these songs are silly. It's called Captain Three Leg.
Yeah.
And but he found like a bunch of stuff of theirs, like this actually would be great for like these night driving songs, and so that was awesome. And just, you know, we did recreations in Ottumwa, and I had to deal with a lot of the city and getting like major roads shut down.
Mm-hmm. So probably bigger than Chiefs.
Yeah, and I mean, I also dealt with some pretty large, like I did, I had to do a lot of like some of the deals on some stuff, which I did not think I'd be dealing with, but they hired me in the deep COVID. So it was like August of 2020 and they sent me down there and I was on that for 3 months, mm-hmm. just like doing the prep work on a weekly and then down there for 2 weeks mm-hmm. shooting. And that was when it was like a 10-day shoot, you know, like you're typically have 10 days and then we had a couple, like 4 days after that of recreations. Mm-hmm. So, and it was just, that was a big one and it was high profile. Cause the director was also, executive producer on that show Vikings.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So that one was just, that was a pretty big one. I mean, Chiefs, I would say Chiefs is up there with Queen of Meth.
Yeah.
But Queen of Meth was the first one that like, they got me in early.
Yeah.
I mean, they had been greenlit beginning of July. Mm-hmm. And I was hired like August 5th or something.
Yeah. So for Chiefsaholic, you got to be there for, I think, every interview.
Yes. The only thing I was not there for was two Verite shoots. Mm-hmm. I was there for every interview. I was not there for when Michael Lloyd had to pay his $80,000.
Yeah.
I was not there for that.
Which is what legitimately like one of the scenes people ask about the most. So like that's a great segue for you. Now you've seen the film a couple times. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite scene? Or what do you think is the most powerful scene?
The most powerful is him winning the Super Bowl bets. But I've also watched that over and over again because Dylan would start it in the studio and I would usually leave shortly after that just because it's a long movie. But I think that because that was also all of our first experience with Xavier was right there. I met him the scene where he is winning the MVP bet in the Roach Motel. That was the moment I met him because mm-hmm. I had come in from Vegas on a commercial shoot and flew in and we were at the Peoria Inn. And we were all in this room and we had the sound guy from Tiger King in there who I was just like, I hate to admit it, I hired him literally because of that.
Well, then he went on to work on Twisters too.
He did work on Twisters. Yeah, Brian Gilland.
Yeah, shout out, man. And a helicopter pilot.
He's too. A helicopter. He was like studying to be a helicopter pilot. I would invite him to go do things on our days off or when we were done with the day, and he was just like learning to be a helicopter pilot.
Yeah, dude, shout out for like his dedication. We'd go have beers. We'd go have Modelo's or something, and he would go back to his room and study.
He's really impressive. He was the one that really didn't care about production. He wanted to be a helicopter pilot.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a lot of conversations about Tiger King. So I'm like, this is why I hired you. No, tell me stories.
Yeah, we had some.
Your sound could be medium. You know, I don't care. His sound was actually great. But, like, his sound could have been just mid and I would have been happy.
Yeah, because he worked on Tiger King. Yeah.
That was the most – I think that was just, like, kind of an intense situation because I met him and, you know – he had just gotten out of jail like the day before mm-hmm. and there were these talks that I remember this is where I started like what or what? And there was this conversation that Michael Lloyd was going to take him to the Super Bowl. And I was like, what judge would allow that?
None.
And so thankfully when he was denied, look, if they said yes, this could be a very amazing thing we're about to go do.
Yes.
But
different doc. If that happens.
Different doc. A lot more things in question mm-hmm. if that happened. You know, there was this bit of Looney Tunes to it that I also like was really enjoying because you also got to remember like Dylan and I had just wrapped Taken Together mm-hmm. and like this was the bank robber Looney Tunes super fan thing was just lighthearted enough to like kind of ease numb the pain that we just went through. So that part I think was pretty like just intense. It was also like all of us together for the first time, like what are we doing? Mm-hmm. You know?
Because at that point we really didn't know yet what we were doing. We were kind of exploring this character of Xavier, and we didn't really I think Dylan knew a lot or had inclinations about the story.
Yeah, he did. I think what threw us all through a curveball was when he wouldn't sit down for the interview.
Yeah, we thought that was strange.
We're like, what's going on? We're all here. Mm-hmm. We brought you the party. And then...
Tell your story, man.
Tell your story. And then, you know, I think hooking up with all the super fans doing those interviews... Like, I remember when we did... Just Fidel was our first one.
Yes.
And Fidel, like, just, A, one of the nicest dudes... And just like
opened up a huge can of worms.
Oh my God. Opened up like just like his theories behind things and him just like talking about being a super fan. Mm-hmm.
A diehard.
Yes. He's a diehard. That's a big difference. Yeah. Big difference. And really put things in perspective for at least for me.
Of how like big Chief's Kingdom was and how serious this super fandom and diehardness was.
I didn't care, but like it was not.
We didn't pay attention.
Yeah,
like Dylan's a Chiefs fan.
Yeah, he's not a super fan,
but he likes the Kansas City Chiefs. He pays attention to the football, so he's familiar with the Chiefs Kingdom. I think I'm a sports fan. I'm not necessarily a football fan, and I know fandom, but like the fandom that we witnessed in what is it February 22 when we went down and filmed the championship game.
February 23. Yeah,
We were all like, just like, these people are nuts. This is bizarre, such a bizarre world. And then you have this figure of Xavier who's like in this bizarre world, but then has this whole like dark past behind him and like this whole backstory that is even more bizarre. And I remember like kind of not knowing where we were going a lot of the time, but like knowing that there was something worth exploring.
Yeah. I mean, and I would say too, when we were, that day that of last year, 2020, February or January of 24, when we were shooting one of the Polar Vortex, and our executive producer Andrew Renzi took Dylan and I to the Chiefs game in the 40 below,
to the coldest NFL game
in history, I think. And there were people there buying beer in the men's room because that was where the beer wouldn't freeze. But by the time I got back to my seat, my beer would be foam. Mm-hmm. That was like, I was like, all right, I get it. Like when I was a kid, I followed the Detroit Lions during Barry Sanders' tenure. One of the greatest football players of all time for one of the worst teams of that era. Now the Lions are like one of the greatest teams.
They're Super Bowl favorite possibly.
And I'm just like, man, wouldn't it be ironic if it's a Lions-Chiefs game? That'd be like, for me personally, that's a full circle.
And kind of wrapping up our conversation about Chiefs, like, what is it, whether it's a behind the scenes story or something that like really stuck with you, what is something you want people to know about the film that they wouldn't know if you didn't tell them right now? Is there a story? And I know we talked about some of them, but is there something else that sticks out to you that what do you want people to know?
I just want people to know that it was not an easy film to make. And it could only have been made, because there was another movie made about it. And they're very different. Mm-hmm. The movie we made could only have been made with the group that made it. And that is something that I don't say that lightly, because it was extremely hard and patience and ambition really are what made that movie. So I don't have an individual story. We don't have that type of time. I mean, you got my Super Bowl fever dream.
Which is probably the coolest story for
me. For me, yeah, that was the coolest one for me, even though like there's literally one frame from that in that movie.
Yeah.
In that whole $15,000 trip, there's one frame.
That's why I want to talk to Dylan about like what was our ratio of footage to. That's what one thing I want to talk to him about.
Well, they used a lot.
Yeah.
They used a lot.
But we shot a lot. I want to know how much ended up on the cutting room floor too. But with a project like this, it inevitably ends up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. I know at least one full interview that didn't even make it in there.
Yeah. But to summarize what you said about it being the crew that really stuck with you, I think to give the listener an idea, this is a crew that like literally has been in the making for like 12 years. I met Dylan 12, 13 years ago mm-hmm. when Dylan was the lead singer of his band Sires. Mm-hmm. I met him in Waterloo, Iowa, Cedar Falls, Iowa. And I've known Dylan for like 12, 13 years. He started drifting more to the multimedia, filmmaking, video production side. Then I moved to Des Moines, met Christian, who grew up in the same area of the Midwest I did, the Quad Cities of Iowa and Illinois. And it's like a decade mm-hmm. of like knowing you guys. And then we find ourselves in Chiefsaholic, yeah, which think, I think is I really special.
I don't think it could have been made any other way. I mean, I think we were all in it. And even though there was times where just like, maybe I don't want to be in it right now. But so I think it was that group of people that made that film what it was.
Yeah. And I think that's a great way to end this episode. Yeah. Thank you so much for talking to me about Chiefsaholic, and thanks for making that film with me. This is career highlights. Yeah, yeah. Cool. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Bruce James Bales. That was Dylan Sires and Christian Day, and that's a take.